Hello and welcome to The Thriller Zone. I'm your host, David Temple, and thank you so much for spending time with this podcast. I got a really special guest today. I will admit that I had not read her work before. I frankly wasn't even familiar with her. But when I got hold of her book, The Heights, let me tell you something. Louise Candlish very quickly became a person of interest. No, I mean, an author that you can say, oh my God, she's good. Well, yeah, she's a Sunday Times bestseller, and she has 15 hits on her hand, one of which is becoming a television series. So I thought, being the multimedia fan that I am, I gotta talk to her. And this turned out to be one of my favorite episodes. Why? Well, she's brilliant, she's charming, she's funny, she's sweet, she's super creative, and we just kind of clicked. You know, you ever meet somebody and you just kind of click? That's how I felt with Louise Candlish. So, first of all, let me say, this is a book you may want to read. You really do. Second of all, how about you and I get into the Thriller Zone?
Hello.
Good morning.
Or Good afternoon.
Aren't you lovely?
Oh, thank you. Aren't you?
Oh, thank you.
Let's start as we mean to go on.
Yes. I was sitting here having a cup of coffee and I thought, oh, I wonder if Louise is going to be having a cup of tea. And then I went, wait a minute, let me check my international clock. Oh, it's 4:30 her time.
Yeah, I should be having a nice cup of Earl Grey. I've actually got a glass of water because I've got a sore throat. And so I just need to make sure my voice doesn't get, you know, huskier and huskier as we go. Otherwise, I would have a nice cup of tea, British style.
And I've always wondered this, is milk or cream always the thing with tea, or does anyone drink it plain?
Black.
Yeah, black.
Yeah. Well, we would never have cream. I think that's like something from My Fair Lady or something, maybe the 19th century. But yeah, I have milk in tea, but you know, many people I know take it black or have lemon. But it is, I mean, you're right to ask because it's a ritual and those details are important to us and not to be taken lightly.
No, I know you take tea very seriously. So I, you know, and I'm going to have to fight tooth and nail not to slide into some kind of an accent because I love your accent. And I'm waiting to travel to London one day and have someone from London come up to me and go, oh, I love your accent. I know I will have then made it.
I'm sure it will happen. Yeah, it could. I mean, I guess we don't love American accents in the way that you seem to love our accent. But I think maybe that's because ours just has that kind of weird, you know, formality to it, whereas you're so easy and, you know, it's not so mimicable as a British accent. So I just think our accent gets so much more attention, doesn't it?
Yeah. I also find it interesting, since we're just gabbing here before we actually officially start, I find it interesting that English can impersonate American accents better, in my opinion, than Americans can impersonate English accents. British accents.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I'm sure there are actors who are American actors who are fantastic at British accents.
Yeah.
But I always assume that it sounds terrible to the native listener. Do you know what I mean? So you may think that your fellow American's British accent is great, or and I might think vice versa. Probably it's not ever 100%. But I'm now racking my brains to try and think of, because there have been times when you just think, well, what about Kate Winslet in Mare of Easttown?
Good was that show,
I need to think of one the other way around, though, don't I? I need to think of an amazing American doing a British accent. I can only think of Nicole Kidman.
Oh, yeah. Which is Australian.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. It's a challenge. I'll try and think of one, but there will have been some excellent performances, I'm sure. I know. What about Meryl Streep as Margaret Thatcher?
Oh, okay. Yes.
I'm pleased with that. She was brilliant.
I was just going to say brilliant. Yes. Excellent pull. Okay. Well, Louise, what a handsome, by the way, handsome cover. I'm a big fan of covers. We're going to get to the Heights in just a second. I think you have one of the best cover blurbs on here. Louise Candlish is the queen of the sucker punch twist by Ruth Ware. Man.
That's such a good... Are we recording now, by the way?
We are recording. By the way, inside scoop, and I do this to everyone, I record from moment one.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah.
To moment end. I have learned through the years that some of the best stuff just happens.
Yeah, no, yeah. Absolutely. Well, in terms of that quote, oh my God, Ruth must rue the day that she gave it, because it's just been used and used and used, and, you know, lots of different markets will use it on their editions. And it is, you know, I couldn't have paid a copywriter to come up with a better quote. But also it can feel sometimes like, I'm being hoisted by my own petard, to use that extremely old-fashioned phrase, in that you see that on the cover and you're expecting a twist, you're looking out for the twist, it's all about the twist. And sometimes, as I say to my marketing team, it would be really great if we didn't advertise the twist, and then it really is a sucker punch surprise. Whereas if someone says to you, at some point in this conversation, I'm gonna punch you, you know, you're slightly braced, aren't you? And that's very different from being in relaxed mode.
Right. It's interesting because you just brought up a really great point. When people walk up to you and they go, Louise, I've got the funniest story in the world. Oh my God, this is so funny. Oh, you're going to laugh. And they set it up. And then they tell you the story and you're like, it's not really that funny.
Yeah, no. Exactly. I mean, you know, manage expectations,
right?
Please. But it is that sort of balancing act with publishing where, you know, you've got 100,000 books being published that week or whatever the, you know, ludicrous number is. And you've got to stand out, and, you know, author endorsements are really important, and, you know, sensational claims tend to make their way to covers. But as the author, it's, you know, the dream would almost be for your books to be in little brown packages and no one knows what they're getting. And then they discover this story. They've never heard of the author. They've just completely absorbed in the story. And they say to their friend, I just read this great book called The Heights. And they don't know, they didn't know anything about it when they went in. And they don't need to know what the author's famous for, or what the brand means, or any of that stuff. It would be really lovely if it was just about the merits of the contents, wouldn't it?
That's such a superb notion, and I completely agree. And it's so funny. When I meet people like yourself that make me stop and go, wait, that is such a good idea that I know I'll hang up later and I will make a note of this. And that is to always be aware of things. It's like when I read excellent writers like yourself that challenge me to go, wow, can I craft a better sentence? Can I be better? Then those are the people that really affect me. And this book kind of did this because, and it's funny, I didn't, I read so many books, Louise, for this show, that often because I get the press blurb that goes along with it, and I often will go real cursory because I don't want to know anything. Yeah. I want to just dive in and be surprised. Anyway, all of that is...
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree with you. And I also get, you know, packages of books all the time with the press release, with the special letter from the editor or the author. And, you know, there's the blurb. And I don't read it. I want to start the book and learn what it's about myself. I don't sort of need to have that kind of, you know, all the main selling points signaled to me. But I do appreciate it's hard. It is hard for publicists and marketeers to, you know, kind of shout loudest. But, you know, the true reading experience should be a bit quieter and very personal, and not really about what someone else thinks about that book, but what, you know, what you think about it.
Yeah, and to belabor this point one step further, if the marketing people didn't polish the jewel to its brightest significance, then in a world where our attention is so cluttered with so many things, you know, then we might not see it.
That's a good point.
Yeah. But being a Sunday Times bestseller as yourself, it probably every day is just like a walk in the park, and you're like, oh, you know.
That's so not true. Because ultimately it's about, you know, wanting to carry on having a writing career and wanting to do something different the next time. And, you know, it's really a sort of point of honor for me to not repeat myself, although I'm sure readers of all 15 of my novels will notice there's a, you know, a few overlaps in theme, but I'm always trying something different structurally. I've always got new ideas waiting and bubbling and waiting to be kind of woven into a story. And so, ultimately it's about the ideas and the creating something new each time. I think, you know, sometimes I think it would be great to have a period of complacency and resting on my laurels. But, you know, because I could then, you know, be really lazy, which I do quite enjoy, rather than this kind of, you know, crazy, you know, juggling of projects, which I'm doing at the moment. But ultimately, I couldn't bear to see messages on from readers saying, oh, this isn't one of her best, or not as good as the last one. And, you know, inevitably readers have favorites, but I just, oh my God, it chills me to imagine letting readers down when they've come, you know, a lot of them have come with me for 15 books.
This begs so many questions. Do you read your reviews?
Yeah, I do. I have Google alerts. I don't read every single, you know, Amazon review or Goodreads review, but, you know, I would frankly have jumped off a bridge if I had. but I'll read the press reviews, and I do have a lot of interaction with readers on social media, which I absolutely love. Obviously, if someone's mean, then I try not to engage. So it's kind of cherry picking the nice interaction, but, you know, gotta have some perks. I try not to be instructed by reviews. Because I really like to follow my own instinct about what I should be writing. And, you know, I've got a great editorial team and they know best, you know, over a reviewer who might, you know, be in a bad mood that morning when they take on your work. So I don't use them to, you know, to shape my future, but I do enjoy reading them. And, you know, I absolutely believe in constructive criticism, and I believe in, you know, unconstructive criticism as well. I just believe in, you know, opinion and free speech, and, you know, it's interesting to hear what people say, but there's that sort of psychological thing, I don't know what it's called, where, you know, you scan for problems and the negatives, and you sort of literally do that when you go down the Amazon reviews or, you know, the Google search. You know, your brain is like completely overlooking the best book I've ever read lines and seeking the load of old piffle line.
It seems so counterintuitive, but it is true. It's like, I want to see what the dumbass says really nasty about me.
And what it's so true.
Yeah. And what I despise are the people who get on there and go, I hated this piece of rubbish and here's why. Blah, 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 blah. And then they tell the entire story and they go, well, there's this one thing. But then they give you a star and a half or something. If you hated it that much, why did you spend all that time on it?
Yeah. I think it's more personal than just not liking the book, don't you? I think there's some underlying issues there.
Oh, and call me nasty person, but sometimes I want to hunt those people down and go, you know what? Well, I don't like your hair there.
Yeah. I don't like your shoes.
Yeah.
But I don't tell the world.
Yeah.
Well, no, it's a strange thing. I think it's a kind of codependency we've created. And it's interesting. I was talking to one of my books is about to be on screen here. Our house, and I just met up with a screenwriter yesterday, and I said to him, oh, you're so lucky that screenwriters don't seem to have to kind of front their brand in the way that an author does, because, you know, your work is marketed and promoted by household name actors and actresses and, you know, all well-known directors. You know, sometimes I feel a bit sorry for myself as an author that we kind of, there's only us to sort of be the promotional figure, when actually it might not suit our personalities. And generally writers, I think, are quite introspective, you know, have that sense of being an outsider. You know, that's why we're doing the job we're doing. And so to then be asked to be a kind of stand-up comedian with no media training is, you know, it's a bit odd. It's a bit counterintuitive, but, you know, we're giving it our best shot.
Well, it's clear a couple of things. First of all, you must have started writing right out of grade school by your youth and your fervor.
I think that's the Zoom screens flattening the years.
Oh, if you got that you got that setting off.
No, I didn't. Someone told me about the filters. I don't do the filters, but, you know, there is the nice afternoon light. But yeah, I started writing in my early 30s.
What?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, early 30s, and I'm now in my early 50s, so it's been 20 years.
Well, life has been very grand to you. By the way, you must be looking over my shoulder as my notes, because I was going to congratulate you on your number one bestseller, Our House, which won the British Book Awards Crime and Thriller Book of the Year in 2019. And now this is the one that's going to be the 4-part series on ITV.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Written by Simon Ashdown. I should name check this anonymous screenwriter that I was just talking about. Yeah, he's done a fantastic job, because those who have read it among your listeners, your audience, will know it's a hugely complicated book, with many meta strands and all kinds of stuff going on and multiple themes, and at the heart of it, you know, quite a complicated fraud plot. And so it was no mean feat to, you know, kind of deconstruct it, to simplify it, and to, you know, preserve the essence of it and all of the drama and suspense, while, you know, ridding it of the complexities that a novel reader can sit with a, you know, cup of coffee and enjoy putting the puzzle together, but you just can't do on screen. So yeah, they've done a fantastic job, and I'm really excited to see it air in a few weeks time.
Will it air internationally, I'm assuming, right?
I think it will. Yeah, I don't have a date yet for US, so, but I have no doubt it will be on screen there at some point, but perhaps not at exactly the same time as the UK.
And excuse my ignorance, ITV to you.
ITV. Yeah, ITV is like a big network, one of the main networks here, like BBC. I guess it would be like ABC. No, do you have ABC?
ABC,
something like that, yeah.
And all right, so it's going to be commercial television, not something streaming like Netflix or an Amazon.
That's right. Yeah. And ITV has its own hub. And I think often the ITV shows go on BritBox. Yeah. So that may be where it lands. But I'll let everyone know as soon as I have information. At the moment, I just don't have clarity on the different markets. So I don't want to misinform you.
But do please gain clarity and remind me when it comes, because my wife and I love anything British television. We watch all of it. It's ridiculous. We find ourselves going deep down the rabbit hole of, okay, that was a great detective series. And then, you know, how they'll do that drop down. If you like this, you'll like this. And then we watch all of those. And if you like that, you'll like this. And we watch all of those. It's
brilliant. And then there's often so many, aren't there, as well. And you can go back, and now we've got the prequels. And yeah, it's, you could spend the rest of your life watching British detective shows.
I love it. I'm trying to think of one that we just finished. Oh my goodness. I probably shouldn't waste time on it, but it was a psychological thriller about this modern house.
Oh, it was probably The Girl Before.
Yes.
Yeah. On HBO.
Brilliant.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I know the producer. Yeah. It's fabulous. Really good. Yeah.
We
really
were mesmerized, and we thought at first, oh, it's going to be this. And then it becomes
this. And at the end, it's this. And you're like, wow, that's so hard to do, Louise, to be able to tell a story.
I think the author wrote the screenplay as well, actually. I hope I'm not telling a lie, but we watched that recently and it's fantastic, really good. And I think all the better for being, you know, just in the three parts. I think the short series, are my preference in a way, because you know, you don't have to commit the 8 hours or the 10 hours and you can conceivably watch it all in one night, with a bottle of wine. And it's just like a dream night in.
I like your thinking. Yes, the bottle of wine is such a nice accoutrement.
Yeah, I think so. When it's getting too late for the Earl Grey.
Yeah, and okay. While we're still on this, and yes, we're coming to the Heights. I follow you on Twitter, and you were sharing a screen grab of a scene from ITV's Our House, and I love it. You said that you were going to faint. It was great. So for my listeners who don't fully understand perhaps the process of writing a book, then having, you know, Hollywood, we'll use the phrase Hollywood because it's purchase the rights and turn it into a film or a TV show. Can you kind of share that experience? Like, what happens when you go, you finish this book, it gets really great reviews, and all of a sudden one day somebody shows up and says,
Well, it's all handled by your agent. So I have an amazing book to film agent. Who is, you know, the top book to film agent in the UK and does deals, you know, sort of multiple deals a day. And so he will get in touch and say, I've got all of these production companies who want to option the book. Let me tell you, you know, what they're suggesting. Some of them might already have a pitch, you know, a kind of artistic vision. Then you'll have a series of meetings. You'll choose who you want to work with. And then things go quiet for a bit. And they might go quiet for a couple of years, actually. And in that time, the producer and the writer are putting together a treatment and maybe a pilot, a speculative pilot. In the case of Our House, I think the pilot might have been commissioned directly by ITV, and then the full series on the back of that. So that could take a year or 2 years. I'm trying to figure it out. We had our first meeting about Our House, the TV show, it was probably October 2018. So 2.5 years later, it's going on screen, and that's considered very smooth, very fast. And then once the script is written, I've seen it at that sort of stage, and there's multiple stakeholders giving notes. They will then have a budget and start casting, start offering money to stars. And so with Our House, it was, you know, a big moment when Martin Compston got on board. You probably know him from Line of Duty. He's a massive star here, but he's sort of gaining national treasure sort of status, really. Very, very likeable and hugely popular actor, and, you know, also fantastically talented. So to get him on board was, you know, a red letter day. And after that, things happened very, very quickly, tumbled forwards compared to the sort of, you know, the slightly more elongated process earlier on. Suddenly there's, you know, casting going on all the time. They're putting the set together. They hunted for the house, which is, you know, central to the whole book and to the TV show. And then they've got a shoot date. And then that took place, I think, over about 12 weeks. And then since then, there's been post-production and probably about a week in between the, you know, signing off the finished thing and it going on air. So it's kind of odd. It feels like nothing happens in the beginning and it all happens at the end. But I know that that is not true. I think it's just things happening behind the scenes and, you know, all of the relationships and the timing and scheduling issues that go into putting a project together have all got to be managed. It sounds like a massively complicated negotiation, and I'm quite pleased to have just been on the sidelines, dipping in and out without having to bear any of the stress.
Yeah. Mark Graney, I don't know if you're familiar with the Gray Man series. He was on the show a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, okay. Yes, I've heard the name. Yeah.
Yeah. Incredible writer, sweetest guy ever from Memphis. And he, the reason I bring this up is I think The Gray Man, that is going to be coming out, thanks to Netflix, very soon. I think he first sold that story in 2009.
So it was, my goodness.
Yeah, it was in and out or somewhere around there, in and out. And yes, we're going to do this and no. And then, we're going to pick it up and run with it. So yeah, it is a laborious process that people are not aware that it takes so much time because it's purchasing, it's negotiating, it's adaptation.
It is. And it's, I think timing is a huge factor, and it just makes you realize how incredibly tenacious the producers and the writers are in pushing stuff forwards. Because I think it must be heartbreaking to feel like it's about to start and then something breaks down in the, you know, hugely complicated chain. So it does make publishing feel quite uncomplicated. And that in itself is a form of alchemy. So, you know, it's been a really interesting learning process for me. And particularly as more books are being adapted now, I feel like, you know, I've had such a great experience with Our House to see just how incredibly hard people work and just how many of those people there are in the process.
Yeah. But in the end of the day, it's a dream come true, right?
No, it really is. It's quite surreal, actually. And, you know, I have to remind myself to, you know, celebrate and try and engage fully, because it does feel quite surreal sometimes when you see, you know, sort of famous actors speaking, you know, lines in the voice of your character, especially if you think of the very casual beginnings of some of, you know, a novelist's project. You might just be sitting on the sofa, you know, like reading the paper and, you know, have an idea. And so it is a very kind of grand endpoint to, you know, often a very quiet birth.
And it's so funny you bring up something I'm going to ask you later, and that has to do with the fact that, you know, where ideas come from. And yeah, you're sitting there thinking to yourself, you're at a coffee shop or a tea shop or whatever you're shopping, you're at the lake, and an idea comes on you, oh, this would be interesting. And then if you are like me, I'll sit on an idea for weeks, sometimes months, sometimes years, and it will just sit there kind of like simmering on the back burner like a nice stew. And then one day, it'll kind of start to fall together, and you'll sit down and you'll start writing. Before you know it, you're halfway through it. And then to your point, you're living my dream, by the way, you wake up one day, you flip on the telly, and all of a sudden,
it's a trailer absolutely. No, I think you've described, you know, the creative process really well. And because that's exactly how it feels for me. I normally have 3, 4, 5 big themes or ideas or obsessions or inspirations in a novel. And, you know, so some of them might have been sitting there for a couple of years waiting for their place. Because you have to have a really credible plot line to kind of bring it all together. And that's what takes the sort of gestation, I think. So with The Heights, for instance, you know, I'd been wanting to write a revenge story for a very long time, but I was just sort of waiting for the right form of revenge to take place. You know, the feud or the incident that sparked it. And in this case, it was, I chose a feud between a kind of overprotective mum and the bad influence best friend of her teenage son. And, you know, because as I said earlier, I'm always wanting to try and take on things from an original angle, or at least from, you know, something that hasn't been discussed for a while. And I couldn't remember seeing that particular relationship explored much. And so so I chose that and, you know, quickly realized it was golden, because it really taps into a big fear of parents of teenagers, which is, you know, you do everything you can to, you know, impress upon them how important it is to get the grades, you know, look after themselves, keep safe, be loyal to the friends that really love you rather than the exciting rogues. And then along comes someone who is just so much fun that, you know, they turn their heads, and this is what happens in a big way, leading to a, you know, a horrible tragedy. So there was the revenge strand, but I'd also for ages been fascinated by and horrified by the Chappaquiddick incident, which obviously you will know far more about than we do in the UK. And so that had been on the back burner. And there's a, you know, you'll, when you read the book, you'll see that, you know, that does have its influence on the plot. It's very hard, isn't it, to talk about without giving the game away. But the other thing that I must shout out is, and I didn't even realize it was an influence until I was about halfway through, is a movie called In the Bedroom, which I probably haven't seen for 15 years. But as I was writing, I was thinking, oh my God, this is a bit like In the Bedroom. And should I, I'll very quickly just, you know, check up on the plot of that so that I'm not aping it exactly. And luckily I wasn't, but some of the, you know, some of the emotion in that film, it's a film about grief and parents taking revenge after a tragedy. You know, there's a direct parallel, and it's a very unusual sort of niche area of thriller and crime, I think. You know, the combination of a parent's grief and crime.
Yeah. Well, you went on such a nice long tangent that
you must edit that.
No. I'm keeping it all. It's all juicy. But I had a couple of questions that I wanted to ask before I jumped into the Heights, but I'm going to keep going because we're in the Heights. And if we have time, because we're about halfway through the show, then I'll come back to it. But a couple of quick things that just popped into my head. And I think of one of my favorite authors from the standpoint of what his talent is, and that's Stephen King. And he says that if you're not reading, you shouldn't be writing, from the standpoint of good writers are good readers. And when I first heard that a few decades ago, I'm like, whatever, I got all the ideas right here. And with time, I'm like, dude, you are so missing it. And he is so right on. And that is that, like reading The Heights, for instance, and a couple of other books that I've got in my TBR stack right now, I find them going, ooh, that perspective, that insight, that nuance challenges me on that book that I have sitting over here in the burner, or, you know, simmering away for the last 2 years. All of a sudden, oh, that thing that she said, or it led me down the path. I'm not taking your idea, but you triggered something in my mind. Went, oh, I hadn't thought of it that way. And then I go back and I pick up that story and I keep going. That's one thing.
No, great point. I know exactly what you're saying. I think the we're all writing a new interpretation on a story that's been told before.
Sure.
And you know, authors discuss this all the time. It's like, oh my God, you know, can I do a all about Eve plot, or the Other Passenger, my last novel was influenced by Double Indemnity, and you know, how many double crossing plots can an industry take? But I think that readers have an appetite for the classic stories, but you know, in new settings, new contexts, new interpretations, twisted, a little bit darker, the characters, you know, representing different generations and different groups. And, you know, it's just, there's an endless supply.
You know, and you, another great idea is that I was reading this article recently. They were talking about, this particular author was talking about, no, I like to come up with something fresh and original each time. And I'm like, first of all, good luck with that.
Yeah.
And then the article went on to say the thing that most readers like is the familiarity. They like the fact that when they pick up a thriller, they know it's a thriller, and yes, it's revenge, and yes, it's a double indemnity cross, and yes, it's seduction, but that's what we're coming for. And all they're really doing is going, how will Louise flavor my this particular theme for me?
And
we want that. Yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, when I say I'm striving to be original, I mean to do something, you know, something that I haven't read recently and something different from what I've written before. But everything we all write is going to have, you know, the shadows of past work. And, you know, sometimes it's quite deliberate. I've a number of my novels have been overtly influenced by previous works. And, you know, I think that's absolutely fine. You must acknowledge it, though. That's the key.
Sure.
You know, you mustn't pretend that you came up with Lolita, because you might get found out.
Yeah. When I first saw the title, The Heights, I thought it was Heights as in, oh, it's a story about mountains or heights. But it's a double entendre. So Heights being, I'm afraid of heights. Ellen, the narrator of the story, has a fear of heights, which I'm going to drill down in here a second. But it's also an area of town called The Heights. But what I did not know about, and I don't have this, but I think I have a... Maybe I have an understanding of it. I did not know that high place phenomenon was a thing until I read it from you. And that is basically like, I have this tendency. I'm not particularly afraid of heights, but I'll go to a height and there's something in my brain that goes, maybe you should jump. I mean, literally out of nowhere. And you're like, wait, what the?
That's it.
I don't want to jump. No, could be something you want to do.
You've just described it. It's quite a niche condition. It's not a sort of full-blown phobia. And there's very little clinical, sort of discussion of it. I probably read all of it when I was researching it, but I've got it myself exactly like you. It's that impulse to step over a ledge or to, throw yourself off a balcony. Or just to, even on a bridge, I might get the impulse to kind of throw my bag off the bridge. So what it is it's not suicidal. We're not depressed. Uh-uh. It just means that it's an intrusive thought. Some people get it, when they're driving on a motorway. Mm. What do you call them? Do you call them freeways?
Freeways,
like a fast road. And you might get the kind of the urge to, kind of ram the steering wheel. Yeah. Into the central reservation and, kill everyone in the car. I mean, that's obviously a, lunatic idea. You're never going to do it. But it's an intrusive, it's a form of intrusive thought. And I've had it all my life. And I don't know whether it's genetic or whether you learn it. Certainly my daughter seems to have it and I fear I've given it to her, either literally and chemically or just, by my crazy influence. But when in discussing the book, I have found that about 1 in 10 people seem to have it.
Wow. Okay.
That's a very informal psychological study.
Okay. So I'm not going to call you Dr. Cantlish.
No. Okay.
It is odd though. I want to spend just 10 more seconds on this is because I've never told anyone this ever. Not my wife. No, I've never until right this moment that I actually.
Oh my God.
Never. Because when I saw the words in one of your press things, and I thought, shit, I think that way. And again, it's not like, oh my God, I gotta just end my life. It's not that. And it's not like, hey, what would it feel like to splat on the concrete? It's not that. It's just that this funny little pull that you're like, well, maybe I should.
Yeah. It's a self-destructive impulse, basically. And the French call it l'appel du vide, call of the void. Which is quite a good way of describing it, isn't it? In terms of how you feel, it's almost like you're being seduced by the empty space.
Yes.
There's nothing, so it doesn't feel like anxiety. It doesn't feel like even agitation. It's it's quite zen, which makes it all the scarier, actually.
Kind of like some of my old relationships. Yeah. scary. Tempting me to come into the void, completely wrong for me. All those things.
Its not own daring, confide in anyone.
Well, thank God I met my wife. Anyway, more about The Heights. A couple things I want to say that I was so intrigued that I so enjoyed. It was the way it was told from two perspectives, and I'm starting to see this maybe a little bit more now. Maybe I'm just becoming a bigger reader, but I love it because it's Ellen and it's Vic. So it's that. The second thing is there's three things. That's first. Number two is the story within a story. I love that idea. And then the twist that you don't see coming. Speak amongst yourselves.
Yes, the story within a story is something, another one of those elements or obsessions that I've had for a while, and I've been waiting for the opportunity to try that out. And it does tend to complicate things a little bit. But just to explain, Ellen, the narrator, is actually telling her story through a crime memoir. She's in a kind of crime-themed writer's workshop. That's where we meet her at the start of the book. And it becomes clear that she's so talented that her memoir, above all others, is going to be published. And then you also have a little bit of commentary from a journalist who is interviewing her for the Sunday Times on publication of this book. So I began on that basis that I wanted it to be written as a crime memoir. But you mentioned that, you know, there is another narrator. There is Vic, who is Ellen's estranged partner.
And I didn't mess it up, did I?
No. And okay. He's the father of Lucas. When I was initially planning it, I just imagined I could do the whole thing as Ellen's memoir. And this is a great lesson, actually. You know, I've written 15 novels and I'm still making huge mistakes each time and learning as I go along. And what I learned as I went along was, hang on a minute, if we've only got Ellen's point of view, how is the reader going to know if what she's saying is true or not? Or if there just might be, you know, some other little details that might have been omitted, you know, it might be, you know, basically true, but we do need someone else's point of view here. And so Vic came along quite late in the process. And then the moment I started writing him, he became my favorite character. And, you know, I felt a little bit sort of disloyal to Ellen in a way because he was so much more entertaining. He's not neurotic as she is. He's, you know, he certainly is, you know, cooler and more easygoing and appears to be more rational as well. And so they're both set up. And just as you're, you know, lulled into Vic's very easy way of explaining what's happened, you're back in Ellen's head. And so it turned out to be, you know, such a brilliant thing to introduce Vic. But, you know, this being me wanting to complicate things, I do have this journalist's voice as well, who, by the way, I voiced in the audiobook. She's a sarcastic journalist, so I was brought in as a natural choice to do these few passages that she writes. But she's a little bit skeptical of Ellen. I think she's, you know, she's not quite as seduced by Ellen as some of the men in her life have been. And so, you know, both the journalist and Vic were able to counter some of Ellen's interpretation of events. And then at the end, it's all tied together. And hopefully everyone's quite clear about what happened. We'll soon find out.
It's very clear, and it's such a satisfying ending. It's so satisfying because it isn't cliche and it isn't a perfect bow, and but it's satisfying. That's all I'm going to say.
Thank you very much.
We can stay with this story, but there's a couple things that are just knocking on my mind's door that I would love to ask you, and that's what's the one thing that you, about having a successful writing career, that maybe you had not expected, or perhaps no one had told you about?
I think it's evolved because I've been writing for quite a long time. I was first published in 2004, but had got the deal a couple of years before that. And so, you know, I've kind of been in the industry now for almost 20 years. It's evolved so much that, so that my answer to that question probably would have changed every 5 years. At the moment, I would say the thing that you're not expecting, for any writers out there who are about to send off their first submission, is quite how much else there is to the job besides writing. So when I began writing, 99% of my job was writing. But here we are 20 years later, and I'd say I'm very lucky in the course of a year if I've even spent 50% of my time writing, because there is so much else to do. You know, as we were discussing earlier, there's, you know, this trend now for authors to kind of front their own brand and lead the marketing. So, you know, in the old days, if there was an announcement to be made, the marketing team, the publisher would announce it. Now the author is announcing everything online. And, you know, that's just the way things are done. And it's across the board in entertainment. It's not just books. It's obviously music. And, you know, we're all directly now engaging with the audience. There's no way I could have predicted that when I, you know, started writing full time. I genuinely thought I was going to be, you know, just sitting with my cat, like Miss Marple or something, you know, right, kind of in a secret world. I never imagined there would be this public persona that was required. And much as I enjoy it, I think that it is a sacrifice in a way, because if you think, you know, if you've got someone whose expertise is in writing stories, and they're only really able to do that for 50% of the time, you're depriving the world of that, you know, 50% of their output. They could do twice as many books if that's all they did. So I think that's the biggest surprise. There are surprises all the time.
Sure.
And they're usually excellent ones. It's just, you know, it's a lovely process, you know, to open your emails and to see good news and new markets opening up for you and lovely comments from people around the world. You know, it's far more rewarding and joyful than I imagined as well. I kind of, you know, had that idea of the bitter and twisted also ran, which I have experienced. I've enjoyed both experiences, that it's never going to happen to me and it's not fair. And, oh, things are happening and this is, you know, way more fun than I even dreamt.
Yeah. Well, I think it's so fascinating that, you know, the days of, oh, I'm going to sit in my library and write that famous book and it's going to take me 2 or 3 years and then it'll be released and everyone will do it for me. I have more and more people on this show that they all say that is so yesterday. And if you're not, you know, so to the point of writing, you know, a book or two books a year, and now part of the machine is, well, you might need to be doing 2 or 3 books a year and maybe even 4 books a year. And if you're doing, back to your point, only 50% of the time, then how can you possibly fit it all in?
Yeah, but I think that even people outside of the hallowed entertainment industry will agree that we all feel like we're doing a lot more now for less gain. You know, so much is required of people. And I think, you know, the work from home experience during lockdown, you know, began by being seen as a kind of very lazy way to do your business, where, you know, you were in fact picking up the kids and pretending you were in a meeting and almost like a Ferris Bueller's day off,
right?
You know, where you've got the, you know, the pillows under the duvet. But actually what it's turned out to be is people working all the time and not having any separation between working life and private life. And, you know, it's a sort of logical extension of you know, the internet and email and the, you know, I mean, I'm sure you, like me, remember a time when if you went on holiday, you said goodbye to your colleagues at 5 o'clock on the Friday and no one knew where you were for 2 weeks. You didn't even leave and may not even have told them which country you were going to. They certainly wouldn't have been, you know, getting in touch with you first thing on Monday morning to ask your advice about something. And so, you know, it's a while since we've had that freedom and that privacy. I can't even remember how we got onto that, but
that's perfectly right. It's the, you know, now everything, now everybody assumes that you will do everything. And, hey, since you can do it from home and while you're already there and you're kind of relaxed, could you also do your marketing here and do the social media there?
And it's not the case that because you're doing it, your team are not doing it. They are doing 3 times as much work than they used to do as well. Yeah. Somehow we've just created so much work. You know, so many, an infinite number of ways of trying to get something to market and tell people about it means that there's an infinite amount of tasks to fill your day. So if you want to not sleep, you could spend 24 hours a day online sharing, you know, news and opinion.
Right. Yeah. And let's take 10 seconds on the social media thing. There is a point where, do you find yourself going, oh, geez, if I don't turn this social machine off, at least for just a little bit. I'm gonna lose my eyesight for one thing.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I feel like I'm mentally ill. I feel like I now can't believe I'm producing novels because I just can't concentrate for the, you know, the lengths. I used to be able to sit down for hours and hours and not look up. And now I'd be lucky if I do 15 minutes without needing to see if a really important, you know, tweet has been shared. Or...
Oh, my God.
So what I do, though, is I have got this new thing, which I recommend, which is if I leave the house, I don't take my phone with me.
Wait a second. I need to sit down a second.
So it's like mini digital detoxes. So, you know, if I walk the dog every day and I don't take my phone with me. So I know I've got a guaranteed hour where I'm not thinking about my phone. Because let's face it, it's not the internet, it's the smartphones that have,
yes.
You know, have ended our sanity as we knew it. So yeah, that's my top tip.
Well,
don't take your phone.
How are you going to listen to my audiobook that I'm going to send you?
Well, this is then the problem, isn't it? That where everything is in the phone. So you've got to, is there a way of listening to it through like FM or, you know, through your car radio or old style, or do you have to have a device to listen to your podcast?
If you've got a smart car, you can listen to it on your car, you know, but your phone usually goes in the car to tell the car to listen to.
Yeah. You know. This is the problem. It's certain elements I want rid of, but I don't want rid of all of the elements, you know, because your music might be on your phone and, you know, your banking, you might need your phone. Also your camera's on your phone. I think this is the great evil of the whole thing is that everything is in one device, isn't it?
And it's all on purpose, young lady. I mean, come on, think about it. The guys who created this are completely aware that this is the biggest addiction since blank.
Absolutely. They are monsters. They are monsters. They are, you know, as it's often said, they are the Escobars of our age.
It's true. And think about it. I've heard people go, oh my God, I went to leave the house and I had to try and go back because I didn't have my phone. But when you, to your point, if you're doing your banking and listening to your music and your podcast and taking your photographs, I mean, there will be a day, you know, there will be a day where this will be implanted on us somewhere. So we won't have to worry about a physical piece of property.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Because the sheer anxiety of losing it is, you know, another cross to bear, isn't it?
Remember the days when you'd like, well, you can't change your number because all my friends know the number. Then you go to ask years later, what's Louise's number? I have no idea. I just push boom. I push the photograph of her and it dials it.
Yeah. I remember when we used to memorize numbers.
Stop. What? Yeah.
Not having a head for figures. I was only ever to hold about 10 at any given time. But some people used to know, you know, like dozens and dozens of numbers just off the top of their head.
I used to know all the numbers. I mean, that yeah. Oh God. If I knew 30 people, I knew all their numbers. The thing is, it's made us lazier. It's that's what it's done is it has just made us flipping lazy.
Yeah.
Well,
infantilized. I feel infantilized.
Oh, goodness.
I feel like I've got no agency.
You make everything sound so brilliant. All right, before we roll on to rapid fire questions, because I know I've only got so much time with you, I do want to ask this, and you've kind of hinted at it, but this is one of my favorite things about asking authors, especially such prolific ones as yourself, to give insights to, let's face it, I'm rarely asking for me, but I have listeners who are also wannabe writers, but we want to know what's your best piece of advice?
I think if you're wanting to sell your work and, you know, get an agent and get a publisher and be a commercial writer as opposed to just writing for your own pleasure, then you really need to have the most incredible hook to your story. You must have that concept, that kind of strong crime or strong dilemma at the heart of the story that can lead the sales pitch. I think if you're struggling to explain to your mum or your best friend or your husband or your wife what the book's about, then, you know, that's not a great sign. So I don't even start now until I can crystallize my idea and sell it in a copy line. I actually used to work as a copywriter, so, you know, I find that fun. But it's a very good exercise for everyone to imagine your book is already in the hands of a publishing team and someone is writing the blurb on the back of the book or, you know, the inside flap. You know, how would that read? What's the crystallized essence of the story? And, you know, is it intriguing enough sounding? So I think it's really that. Don't start properly until you're absolutely confident of your central hook.
And that was brilliant, by the way. I do have so that I can break it down one extra step, and I totally get it. And let me see, let's bounce this off. Let's workshop this a second. If I were to pitch you, Louise, I have this great idea. It's about a cop who is investigating a murder in Hollywood and things go awry. Okay. Right there, you're going to go, excuse me.
Right? Where's my phone?
Yeah. Right. Because... I'm taking the phone and I'm walking Birdie.
Yes.
But let's turn that around so that, in this workshopping environment so that you could say, okay, David, idiot, how about we flip this around a little bit and pretending that you would actually know what my story is about? How would you do that differently that would go, okay, now you're on to something?
Well, I think, that's obviously a classic crime story, isn't it? So you need to either bring a twist in the way it's narrated or structured, or a twist in the narrator themselves. So, you know, maybe you're telling the story from, you know, the point of view of a family member of that cop, or the victim, or someone unconnected but somehow randomly involved. I think you just need to bring a new agenda to that old story, to kind of refresh it.
Perfect. Okay. And that makes total sense. I got it. All right. I do have two super quick questions before we do rapid fire questions. I was going to ask the breed of your dog, Birdie, as you call him, Foxy Gentleman. Love that.
But
just this morning, I learned he's a lab.
He is a lab. Yeah. He's a fox red lab. And they are technically blonde labs. And in the old days, the dark ones, the ginger ones, were drowned. You know, they were culled because they weren't popular. But now they're very popular, which is great. So they are all over the place. And he's lovely. And he's called Bertie. And he's actually called Bertie Wooster, named after the Woodhouse character.
Of course. I have never seen a fox red lab. Never seen a fox red lab.
Oh, you must have them in the US.
I'm going to challenge my listeners send me photographs because
see what they say.
I was so in. I love dogs. My dog's called a Carolina dog, which is a North American dingo ancestry. So.
Oh wow!
Ooh, also, fox color.
He looks very, very cool.
He looks very cool. He's got that fox face and a big whipped tail that stands up and brilliant.
How wonderful.
Yeah.
Dogs are a writer's best friend. They really are. They get you out. They're your kind of, you know, uncritical team member.
He is, he must have heard me talking about it because he just walked in here. Yeah. And
I actually banned Bertie from coming in. he does sometimes sit there, but for something of this length, he will be asking me to get up and let him outside.
Yeah.
I put the baby gate up.
Well, he's absolutely beautiful. And the other thing I wanted to ask, and you mentioned it already, and I love this, is the fact that, again, during my Instagram stalking moments, I saw that you're one of the narrators of The Heights, and I wanted to say, what was that experience like, and have you done other audiobooks?
it was great fun. And I had done, I'd previously written a little novella called The Skylight for a literacy campaign here, run by the Reading Agency. And it's a campaign called Quick Reads. So you get best-selling authors and they do a shorter novel. And it's written in a, you know, slightly simplified syntax, but the plots are, you know, juicy, like a full length novel. There, it's for adults struggling with literacy as opposed to kids. So you can be quite adult in your themes. And I was asked to do the audiobook of that because it's a charity thing. And, you know, we didn't really have any budget for an actor. So, you know, I agreed, but, you know, thinking that, you know, I would probably hate it. And, you know, but it was a, you know, a good deed. But no sooner had I started than I was just loving it and fantasizing about having a new career as an audio narrator. It was ridiculous. It was, you know, a very, very, you know, 1 to 100 miles an hour,
yeah,
in terms of confidence,
yeah,
from this kind of, you know, meek and mild, oh, I don't think I'm going to be very good, to I'm owning this. It happened very quickly. And so I secretly hoped I might be asked back for another gig. And so when the role of the Saki journalist came up and I was asked to do it, I was, you know, I was there the day before.
So we can listen to you where?
I guess it will, when the book comes out on the 1st of March in all its formats, the audio book should be among those formats. So wherever you get your audio books from,
gotcha,
Apple or Audible or wherever, you'll be able to get it. And I, when you hear the Sunday Times newspaper extracts being read, that's me.
Oh, that's so exciting. Well, then you probably recognize this, don't you? This is a
voiceover. Oh, is it? Oh, okay. Yeah, I had to go to a studio in Soho and put on some big headphones, sit on my own. Yeah, no, it was exciting. I felt like a professional actor.
Oh, and you are. You thought that was the sauna.
I'll tell you the big difference, though. I was trying not to speculate as to what that could be. But I think the big difference between a professional, this is ridiculously simplified, but one difference between me and a professional is that I was reading much more quickly than a pro would. Yeah. So you'll probably spot that.
It's fine. Whatever gets it done, right? Okay, it is time for rapid fire questions, which is which is funny in and of itself because it's not really rapid fire. There's no rapid. It's very moderately paced, almost sluggish.
I like the sound of sluggish fire. It gives me time to dodge.
All right. So the first one is fast, but they get slower from there. Pen or paper? Pen and paper or keyboard?
Keyboard.
Music or silence?
Silence or music without lyrics.
Copy that. And we've referenced this earlier and you can make it short. You don't have to belabor it, but where do the majority of your best ideas come from?
I think they come from reading media.
Yeah. It practically writes itself, doesn't it?
Yeah. It's limitless.
I don't know if you're familiar with Meg Gardner. She's a dear friend and a great writer. And she does this crazy, kooky crime of the day. And you could take any one of those stories that are just absolutely insanely hilarious. And they're all just idiots and on Twitter and just make a story out of them. But
yeah. I mean, honestly, the problem is, you know, I think in the olden days, writers had problems with ideas. You know, someone like Joseph Conrad, for instance, famously just couldn't get any ideas. But now we've got too many. We've got too many to choose from.
Right. All right, you're given the opportunity, this is number three, you're given the opportunity to play a lead role in the upcoming television series, The Heights. Who will you play and why did you choose that role?
I will play not Ellen, because that would be too draining an experience and I'll leave that for Kate Blanchett or somewhere like that. I will play Sheridan, who's the sort of slightly desperate friend who, though she doesn't experience a tragedy, like her friend Ellen, she is still struggling with midlife and, you know, the sort of high seas of growing older and having your family leave and, you know, finding a purpose. So I would play her. She's just a small role.
I would love to see that happen. Oh my God.
She's another who likes a bottle of wine of an evening, actually.
And Louise, who doesn't? Okay. Who doesn't? I had one last night. Rapid fire question number four, and I think I already know one of these two answers. What is the one electronic and the one beverage that you can't live without?
It would have to be my phone, even though I'm loath to say that, but only because I feel tricked into being in that position, mm-hmm. not because I've actively chosen it. And the drink would be coffee. Even above alcohol, I would have to choose coffee because I think I am actually addicted to caffeine, whereas I don't think I'm addicted to alcohol.
So coffee, alcohol, tea, is that the hierarchy?
Yeah, no, I'm not such a big tea drinker, actually. I'm more of a, I might have one cup of tea a day, okay. or, you know, one every couple of days. Mm-hmm. But coffee, I will not be able to function without two or three in the morning.
I have just, my wife and I got this new machine called, I think they pronounce it Miele or Miele.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's a great brand. Yeah.
Girlfriend, let me tell you something. We dropped the dime on it, but my coffee consumption has gone through the roof.
How many are you drinking a day then? You have to be careful.
Well, we used to have a standard Mr. Coffee pot, and she and I would go through a half a pot for breakfast. You know, that's about three, maybe four cups a piece, or a, you know, a small pot.
Yeah.
Now with this thing, I'm doing... I do four while I'm doing my morning reading at 5 o'clock.
Right.
Okay. And then I have a two, maybe two more with my midday snack, and then another one in the afternoon or two, and then maybe one after dinner at night. So I'm clocking four or five. Maybe.
How are you even sleeping? I wouldn't be able to sleep for a minute with that amount of caffeine. I've reached the point, and it could be my age, but I've reached the point where I can't really have coffee after about 3 p.m. Won't sleep.
Yeah, Tammy's the same way. I can drink a double espresso and go right to bed. Yeah.
That's amazing. You're so lucky my daughter's like that.
I don't know.
That's like a Dorian Gray gift of youth that you've got going there. I'd love that.
Well, it is quite nice because I love, like, I'm with you though. I'd be my phone and coffee. I couldn't.
Yeah.
I love craft beer and I love a great glass of wine and I'm a nut for a nice gin and tonic, but you take away my coffee and we're going to have words.
Yeah. That's a great question. I mean, you know, we really have to pare down what our, you know, kind of true needs are.
Yeah. All right, last one before I go. My wife and I have invited you to our beautiful home for a cocktail party to celebrate the release of your next novel, yet as named. Shh. We ask that the only thing you bring are two people, they can be living or dead, with whom you think would make for a delightful conversation. P.S. They may be people you've always dreamt of meeting. So you get to bring two people to our party. Who?
Wow. Okay, I would probably bring Frank Sinatra, nice. Even though there's a risk that, you know, things could kick off, I would still bring him because he'd be great fun. And he might also croon for us if we got the karaoke machine out.
God,
so he would be my number one. And then I would also bring more as my bestie who I would want to talk to all night, Roger Federer, so I could quiz him about his genius and his career because I am a huge tennis fan and he's one of my lifelong heroes. Mm. And so if ever I'm asked a question like this, he's my choice because I'll take any opportunity. I was recently asked whose memoir would you like to ghost? That, he's my answer. I can bring him in to to answer almost any question.
That was such a delightful answer. And no one has ever said Frank Sinatra, and it can't get much better than that.
Why doesn't everyone choose Frank?
Yeah. Between the stories, the Vegas stories, the Rat Pack, and that voice.
It would be amazing. It would be amazing to spend an evening with him.
Speaking of amazing, this has been amazing and brilliant.
I've really enjoyed it. I've really laughed.
I think I could talk to you for hours. Don't you get that kind of feeling?
Yeah, definitely. You know? Yeah, definitely. I hope we can meet in real life at some point when travel opens up and, you know, I can tour or something. It'd be great.
Will you be at Thriller Fest this year by any chance?
Do you think? No. I don't have any plans to come to the US this year. But, you know, I'm always open to invitations. So let's see what happens. I've never been to Thriller Fest and I'd love to go at least once.
It's brilliant. I went in 2019. Then of course we missed 20. It is something that you will cherish for the rest of your life because you get to hang out with all your favorite writers and you learn so much and you get to hear their secrets and,
How brilliant. Oh, I would love that. Yeah. I'll definitely do that. That will be on my bucket list.
Matter of fact, when is it coming up? It's
July, isn't it? Usually.
It's actually going to be the end of, I've already made my own little calendar cause I'm going to be there. Will you bear with me? Yeah, here it is. Okay.
Of course.
May 31st to June the 4th.
Oh, wow. Brilliant. Oh, that's quite soon.
I would be happy to.
Yeah, maybe next year then. Maybe next year I'll badge my publisher and get them to invite me.
Well, folks, if you'd like to learn more about this lovely, lovely lady, go to louisecandlish.com. All of this will be here on the screen. Follow on Twitter at louise_candlish and stalk her on Instagram like I do at Louise Candlish. You need to follow me back, Louise, because we can share some stories.
Am I not following you? I'm so sorry. Okay, is it your name?
Well,
I'm
looking for?
Is it the name of the podcast?
You can do the Thriller Zone, or you can do me at David Temple Author.
Okay, I'll do both.
You're the only person that's ever asked me that, so thank you very much for that.
Oh. Yeah. I will. That's the first thing I'll do. I'll go and get the evil phone, and I'll follow you.
Good, because we'll be sharing emails and all that stuff. And
brilliant.
I would love to.
Yeah, just let me know how I can help with, sharing when the podcast's up. Do you have a date, by the way? Do you know when this one's coming out?
Yes, I do. You actually are kicking off the month of March.
Oh, perfect. That's such great timing. Yeah,
I have you.
Publication.
I will have to admit that I had you listed for February, but I thought, wait a minute, her publication is March 1. Yeah. March 1. So I'm going to miss it by 2 days. However, the heat will be beautiful 2 days after because you're going to be completely swamped on the 1st and then it'll air
perfect.
On the 3rd.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This has been delightful.
It's been great.
See, I told you. Louise Candlish. Good, huh? The book, The Heights. You ever read a book where you go, yeah, this is good. And then you, as you continue to read it, you go, no, this is really good. Then you find yourself going, especially if you're a writer like myself, you're like, this guy makes me want to be better. This guy has a debut novel called Every Hidden Thing. And Ted Flanagan, let me just tell you something. This guy is mad talented. Again, I had not heard about him, but he is so interesting. He's a paramedic and a former daily newspaper reporter from Central Mass, and he has a hit on his hands. He is next week's bonus guest. That's right. That means Monday. And this book, I don't know what it is. Style? Yeah. Quality? Oh, yeah. You'd say to yourself, oh, this is like number 10 or 12. Anyway, thank you so much for joining me on the Thriller Zone on this episode. And could I ask you a little favor, just a teeny tiny little favor? Would you swing by thethrillerzone.com and do me a favor and just leave a review? Tell me how you like the show. Do you like the show? Do you hate the show? Do you think it sucks? Do you think it's fabulous? Tell me either way. And on the YouTube channel, which is David Temple Author. I know it's going to become the Thriller Zone soon. I have to have 100 subscribers before I can change the name. Do me a favor and subscribe because it means a lot to me. Seriously. So until next time, I'm David Temple, your host for the Thriller Zone.